If you have your notebooks, you might want to turn to the Aria letterhead section entitled Messianic Prophecy. I'll say some things by way of introduction, and then we're going to focus more specifically on Isaiah chapter 7. I guess I do this. Notice on the top of that page, three things by way of introduction, beginning with New Testament usage. Now keep in mind, when the apostles went out to proclaim, initially to the Jewish people, about the Messiahship of Yeshua, Messiahship of Jesus, no New Testament book had been written yet. There's no John 3:16 to turn to. And they're able to prove the Messiahship of Jesus based upon specific passages in the Hebrew Bible. For example, in Luke chapter 24, verses 25 to 27, Yeshua explains the things concerning himself from the Hebrew Bible scriptures. In Luke 24, verses 44 to 46, Yeshua brings together prophecies from all three sections of the Jewish scriptures, and that is the law, the prophets, and the writings, to prove his death, his burial, and his resurrection, which are the three key elements of the gospel we need to believe. Acts 8, verse 35, Philip presents the Messiahship of Yeshua from Isaiah chapter 53. Isaiah 17, verses 1 through 3, Paul uses the Hebrew Bible to give the evidence of the death and burial and the resurrection of Jesus the Messiah. Acts 18, verses 27 and 28, Apollos' method of debating the Messiahship of Yeshua was to use the Hebrew Scriptures. Acts 28, verse 23, Paul debates with the Jewish elders in Rome using the Hebrew Scriptures, and this was the Scriptures of that day. And the New Testament started to come in a bit later. But on the initial stages, they have no New Testament. Not a single book of the New Testament have been recorded as yet. They're able to convince many Jewish people to come to faith based upon using the Hebrew Scriptures themselves, and we're going to be limiting ourselves, of course, to certain passages throughout this conference, and in my case, more specifically, on Isaiah chapter 7. Now, dealing with different types of messianic prophecy, there are actually four different categories of messianic prophecies, just to discuss them briefly. First category, which is the one we're concerned with in this conference, is those prophecies which deal strictly with the first coming. And one example of many, Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Then you have a second category that deals with the second coming prophecies. And one example, Isaiah chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. And then the third category are those which combine the first and second coming into one picture. The first and second coming prophecies are blended together with no indication that there's a gap of time now 2,000 years long between the first and second coming. A good example is Zechariah chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. For Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9 deals with the Messiah riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, and that deals with the first coming. The very next verse deals with the fact that the Messiah will also remove all weapons of war from Jerusalem and from the land of Israel. That did not take place at the first coming. And so this blends the first and second coming picture into one unit, without implying there's a gap of time. Now we know the gap of time because of some other passages of the Hebrew Bible, but we would not know it from the Zechariah passage. Also Isaiah 11 verses 1 through 5, verses 1 and 2 focus on the first coming, verses 3 through 5 on the second coming and kingdom. And there's no indication of a gap of time between the first and second coming. And that's the third category of messianic prophecies. And then we have the fourth category, the whole redemptive career. And what we mean by the whole redemptive career is will include four elements: something about the first coming, something about the time in between, something about the second coming, and then finally the Messianic Kingdom. And one clear example is Psalm 110, where you have all these four elements together. And so these are the four different categories that deal with Messianic prophecies. Now, the importance of knowing this. Number one, it avoids oversimplification, such as the Old Testament saints looked forward to his death, and we now look back on his death, and have heard that statement made many times. However, the fact Messiah would actually die was first revealed only through one of David's Psalms, Psalm 22, but Psalm 22 doesn't say why he will die. The key passage is going to be Isaiah chapter 53 that clearly says he's going to die as an atonement, as a blood atonement for the people of Israel and ultimately for the world as well. So, when you have only Genesis or only the Torah, the five books of Moses, you would not know anything about Messiah coming to die. So, this is one oversimplification that we can avoid. Further, another oversimplification, that during this first coming, he fulfilled over 300 first coming prophecies, a statement I've seen and heard many times, yet no one was able to give me a list of these 300 passages. What you have in your notebook is all the first coming prophecies, and there's not even near 300 of them, but there are enough of them to clearly certify that Jesus was indeed the Messianic King and fulfilled what was required of the Messiah at his first coming. So it avoids oversimplification. Secondly, it also shows us the manner by which prophecy will be fulfilled. If you look at these prophecies of the first coming, they're fulfilled quite literally. And there's no reason to assume that second coming prophecies will not be fulfilled literally. And therefore, it shows us the way prophecy will be fulfilled and the way they've been fulfilled in the past, they'll be fulfilled in the future, as it is written. And furthermore, those of us involved in Jewish evangelism, we cannot begin by reading the Gospel of John. We're going to give him a Gospel, we're giving the Gospel of Matthew, that quotes the Hebrew Bible quite significantly. But even before we can get to Matthew, we have to deal with the question, what kind of Messiah did the prophets of the Hebrew Bible present? Until we have clearly shown that, we will not actually fulfill what we need to fulfill to get the Jewish mind to begin to seriously consider the seriousness of the Messiahship of Jesus. Now, with this background, let's turn for a moment to Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah's book is divided itself very nicely in 10 specific divisions. His first three divisions cover chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, which he gives three prophetic messages. And in the first three segments, what he does is lay down many motifs that he will develop in detail a bit later in his book. Then chapter 6, he provides us with the authority to be able to claim to be a prophet and prophesying the very words of God. And so in chapter 6, he gives us the details of his call to be a prophet. And then as you move from chapter 7 to chapter 66, all the remaining segments, he begins to develop more in detail the various specific points of the first five chapters. Now, with that concept in mind, look at chapter 1, and let's look at verse 4. Our sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, shorten that deal corruptly, that have forsaken Yahweh, that have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are estranged and gone backward. Why will ye be still stricken, that ye revolt more and more? The whole head is sick, and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even unto the head there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and fresh stripes. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither have been mollified with oil. In these verses we just read, he pictures the people of Israel as one individual a very terribly sick individual, because, and it's a spiritual sickness, so totally spiritually sick with their sins. And in verse 6, notice three key words that he uses, that the people have been disciplined with the wounds, bruises, and stripes. Wounds, bruises, and stripes. Next time we'll see these three words used together. It's one of the most important passages of the Hebrew Bible, and the first coming is Isaiah chapter 53, where the Messiah that takes upon himself these wounds and bruises and stripes on behalf of Israel, so that the body of Israel could be healed of the spiritual sickness. And that will happen individually among the remnant who come to faith, and ultimately before the second coming, the whole nation will come to repentance and faith as well. They'll change their mind about their rejection of the Messiah, and change their mind, repent, and accept him as the Messianic King. Now, so with this background, let's now move to chapter 7. Now, reading verse 1, it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, the Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. Now, he pressed for this historical background that will lead to a key prophecy about the virgin conception and virgin birth. What we have here is dealing with the three kingdoms. There is Israel, there is Syria, there is Judah. They're now facing a threat from a new empire rising, the Empire of Assyria. Now, the country called Syria, that name is actually not this normal name in the Hebrew Bible. It was given, the name Syria is actually originated with the Greeks much later. And when they babbled into English, instead of staying with the Hebrew name, which is Aramea, Aram Aramea, they chose to say Syria. And to avoid the confusion between Syria and Assyria, in place of Syria, I'll be using the Hebrew name Aram or Aramea. And so it is Judah, Israel, Aramea, and the Empire of Assyria. As the Empire of Assyria was rising, the kingdoms of the northern kingdom, Israel, and the kingdom of Aramea, joined their armies together to try to withhold the Assyrian threat. However, they saw they did not have enough people, enough of an army, to be able to counteract the Assyrian army. And therefore, they asked Judah to join them, but Judah chose not to join that union. And the king of Judah is Ahaz, and Ahaz was among the kings that did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. So what initially happens is that the Aramean army goes against the southern part of the Judean kingdom, the area of what is now Eilat, Ezion Geber, and takes it. Israel attacked Jerusalem but could not make the conquest that they were wishing to. So the time we have in verse 1, The Aramean army now came back northward and joined with the army of Israel to come against the people of Judah. And that is the news that is going to come now to Ahaz and to the house of David. So verse 2 says, it was told the house of David, saying, Aramea is confederate with Ephraim. And his heart trembled, and the heart of his people as the trees of the forest that tremble with the wind. Now, with this joining of the two armies together against Judah, that filled the king of Judah, Ahaz, with fear, but also it threatened the house of David. What's important to understand in this prophetic segment is that dealing with Ahaz as an individual and the house of David as a unit. And we'll see why. Ahaz as an individual and the house of David as a unit. And so when the king of Judah learned about this new confederacy now threatening him, two armies, not just one as it was previously, he now begins to fill with fear. He came up with his own solution. His own solution was he would send a large sum of money from the temple compound and send them to the emperor of the Assyrian Empire and ask him to deliver Judah from these two kings threatening him. And he put his faith in being saved physically, not from the God of Israel or the God of Jerusalem, but rather he failed to believe in the Davidic covenant. And because of his failure to believe in the Davidic covenant, the guaranteed no one outside the house of David will ever have the right to sit upon the throne of David is why he trembled with the trembling that he did. The details for your notes about the Davidic covenant are 2 Samuel 7, verses 11 through 17, 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 17, 1 Chronicles 17, verses 10 through 15, 1 Chronicles 17, 10 through 15, and Psalm 89. A long psalm, over 50 verses long, but it emphasizes the importance of the Davidic covenant. So keep in mind that the threat is not only to Ahaz individually, because if that's all the threat was, God might allow them to get away with it if they would simply pick someone else from the house of David to sit upon the throne of David. But the plan goes further, in that they were going to totally remove the house of David from the throne of David and set up a new dynasty totally unrelated to the house of David to sit upon their throne. And that is something God would not let them get away with, because that would violate the promises of the Davidic covenant. So moving now. There we go. The message to Ahaz in chapter 7, verses 3 through 9. The verse 3 says, "Thus says Jehovah unto Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, you and Shar-Yashub your son, to the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field." So Isaiah is told by God to confront Ahaz, who is now inspecting the water supply system, getting ready for another siege. And he's already decided to make the appeal to the emperor of Ahaz. Also notice Isaiah is told to bring his son with him, Shar-Yashub. That's to be a reason why the son is there. And we'll see why he's there. We'll see in a few minutes, but basically to serve as a sign in some capacity. And the place is where the water source was for Jerusalem, the only water source during the period of the Hebrew Bible. And then in verses 4, 5, and 6, we read about the threat against the Ahaz, but also against the house of David. In verse 4, "And say unto him, take heed and be quiet, fear not, neither let your heart be faint, because of these two tales of a smoking firebrands. For the fierce anger of Rezin and Arameum and of the son of Remaliah, because Arameum, Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, have purposed evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and vex it. Let us make a breach therein for us and set up a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. Thus says the Lord Jehovah, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. For the head of Aramea is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin, and within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken in pieces, so that it shall not be a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established." As we come to verse 4, we see the plot against not just Ahaz, but against the whole house of David. And so he gives them a message of comfort of four things. Number one in verse 4, be on guard. He's warning the king against any action that will further remove him from the God he's supposed to be loyal to, the God of Israel. So be on guard. Don't do anything of what you're thinking of doing, asking the help of the emperor of Assyria. Secondly, be quiet. Exhort the king to calmness, and a calmness to be secured by putting his confidence in the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Thirdly, do not fear. And fourthly, do not be faint-hearted. At the end of the second part of verse 4, the object of fear, he says, are simply two burned-out stumps. It's a piece of wood that's been in the fire, a stick of wood, and you remove it from the fire no longer burns, but is still smoking. And that's God's view about these two kings threatening the kingdom of Judah. In that, they're simply two ends of a poker, a stick. They're merely smoking, but will burn no more. They have done all the damage they will do to the Judah and to the city of Jerusalem. They're now just two tail ends of two sticks about to go out. Yes, they have ravaged Judah. They will not succeed in taking Jerusalem. And verses 5 and 6 then reveals the conspiracy that they had against the king of Judah. Three steps. Number one, let us go up against Judah and vex it. They don't want to destroy Judah, they need Judah's army. Just simply to vex it. Step number two, split the city wide open, make a breach in the wall just to be able to run in and take the city over. And the third step, replace the house of Dehu, the son of Tabeel. Ezra chapter 4 verse 7, Ezra 4 verse 7 traces the line of Tabeel much later at the time of the return from Babylonia. And this was a family that was also subsequently anti-Jerusalem. Now Isaiah wrote all of his book in using Hebrew poetry except for four chapters, which is Hebrew prose. And the essence of Hebrew poetry is not rhythm and rhyme as in English poetry, but rather it is parallelism. And sometimes he plays word games. And here's one example that these word games cannot be expressed in English because you don't have equivalent English words. But the way it normally would be pronounced, the name of this imposter is Tavi'el. Tavi'el, meaning God is good. But there was it, but where their words it, it is Tavi'al, meaning good for nothing. He might have been named good for God, or God is good, but he'll be good for nothing. And so, again, keep in mind the threat is not only removing Ahaz. They might have been able to get away with that, but also threatening to remove the whole house of David, and that's what God will not allow for them to get away with, who violate his covenant with David. So in verses 7 through 9, he describes the judgment of the confederacy. In verse 7, he declares this conspiracy will not succeed. It will not be successful. And then in verse 8, in the first part of verse 9, he declares the judgment. As for Rezin, the head of Damascus, he'll be the head of Damascus, he'll be nothing more than that. The second part of verse 8, Ephraim will not be a people in 65 years. We'll come back to that momentarily. Now the prophecy of Isaiah at this point of time was given in the year 735 B.C. And the northern kingdom and the city of Samaria was destroyed in the year 722-721 B.C. That's only 14 years away. So why is he saying 65 years? When the destruction comes only 14 years later. Is he saying that because 65 years from his prophecy, he'll no longer be living? If his prophecy fails, he won't be living to be responsible for it. But if we also go back to other passages, two passages in particular, 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 22 and through 24, 2 Kings 17, 22-24, and Ezra chapter 4, verse 2. Ezra 4, verse 2. What we read is that a later Assyrian monarch, Esarhaddon, in the year 670 B.C., finally shifted the population into full-scale captivity. So if you look, if you go from Isaiah's time of the prophecy till 670 B.C., that's exactly 65 years. And the prophecy was given a specific timetable to a specific fulfillment. Then the verse 9 is, for the son of Ramaliam, he is the head of Samaria. But again, the point is, that's all he'll ever be. He will never be taking over and ruling Judah and Jerusalem. At the end of verse 9, Isaiah declares to Ahaz, if you will not believe, neither will you be established. Here's a word play that doesn't work in English. In Hebrew, it sounds very similar wording. Im lo te'aminu, ki lo te'amenu. If we are trying to play the word game in English, it would go something like this. If Judah did not hold fast to its God, it would lose its fast hold by losing the land. If Judah did not hold fast to its God, it would lose its fast hold by losing the land. Another example, if in God you do not confide, then in power you will not abide. If in God you do not confide, then in power you will not abide. And then the third option, if in God you do not believe, neither blessing shall you receive. Now again, these are not translations of what the Hebrew says because we don't have word-for-word comparisons. But it gives you the effect of the wordplay that Isaiah was using, and he does this a lot throughout his book. So Assyria has become Ahaz's trust. He's putting his trust not in the God of Israel, but in the emperor and the empire of Assyria. If Ahaz would simply look to his God, he would not see the two kings threatening him, Pekah and Rezin. But if he's looking at Pekah and Rezin, he sees only Assyria. So as we come to our next segment, verses 10 to 17. Now what we need to do with Isaiah chapter 7, verses 10 through 17, is to notice the situation in that in Old English, we used to have a difference between you in the singular and ye in the plural, but that's been dropped out of our modern English language. And so many, many renderings use the word you. And from English, you cannot tell whether it's absolute oneness or a compound oneness. And that's what's happening in verses 10 through 17. So there was one place in America they still have a distinction between the singular and the plural you. And that's the land where I now live, the state of Texas. You is singular, you all is plural. I'm going to read verses 10 through 17 in the Texas Standard rendering. And Jehovah spoke unto Ahaz, saying, ask you a sign of Jehovah your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, neither will I tempt Jehovah. And he said, hear you all now, O house of David. Is a small thing for you all to weary men, that you also weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you all a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Barren honey shall he eat, when he knows to refuse the evil to choose the good, for before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you abhor shall be forsaken. Jehovah will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. So the text begins with the singular you. And in verses 10 and 11, he's giving Ahaz a chance to turn away from Assyria and trust the God of Israel. And so in verse 10 and 11, he offers Ahaz a sign. Ask you a sign. No matter what you want, no matter what supernatural event you want, whether it happens up in the heavens or on the earth or below the earth, whatever you ask for, God's going to do. Whatever it will take for you to be convinced, you have nothing to worry about from the threat that you hear and have already partially received, it will not succeed in the end game. But then Ahaz suddenly plays a spiritual game and resorts to the law of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16, Deuteronomy 6:16, I will not, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. But it's a fallacious usage of that passage because what the Mosaic law forbade the Jewish people to do is to ask God to authenticate his promises, his prophecies, by asking for signs. However, in this case, Ahaz is not initiating the request for a sign. God is offering him to perform a sign. And so he could have asked for that sign very easily. But he simply does a pious dodge. I will not tempt. I will not tempt the Lord. He does not want to lay aside his pro-Assyrian plans. So now verses 13 to 14, Isaiah switches from the plural, from the singular you to a plural you. And now he's not addressing Ahaz anymore. Notice in verse 13, hear ye now, O house of David, because they're being threatened as well. And so he now resorts to the usage of the plural pronouns. And he's no longer merely addressing Ahaz. And he tells the house of David, because there's often been unfaithful to the covenantal relationship, if will you weary God, will you weary men, will you also make God tired? Therefore, because Ahaz refused to ask for a sign, therefore behold. And the word behold is in Hebrew a demonstrative article, directing attention to some person or something. It may refer to something in the past or present or future, but if it's used with the active participle, as is found here in verse 14, that is pointing out something future. Isaiah will use the word behold 43 times. It's always something future, one exception is chapter 48, verse 7. Hence, it's not only the birth that is future, the conception that is also future. And then the next phrase, the Alma, the virgin, shall conceive in the future and shall bear a son in the future. Now, with that in article, the first thing you have to ask is, what is he referring to in the immediate context? And has any woman been mentioned since the context began back in verse 1? And there's been no mention of any woman, any Alma. So then you have to go to the larger context. Who would be a woman that the Jewish mind would have know something about, especially with messianic connotations? As the first prophecy of the Messiah in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. I'll put enmity between you and woman, and between her seed. You shall bruise his head, he shall bruise your heel. You shall bruise his heel, and he shall bruise your head. And the first prophecy given of the Messiah is in Genesis 3:15. And so the logical place for Ha'alma, the Alma, the virgin, to be dealing with is with this wider prophecy, going back to Genesis 3:15. Now, in rabbinic theology today, they deny that Alma means virgin. It simply means a young woman. And therefore, there's nothing uniquely about this sign or this messianic prophecy. And let's differentiate Alma with two other Hebrew terms. The other term is the term Ne'ara. Ne'ara or Nara, that usually is rendered as damsel. It's used of a virgin in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 2. 1 Kings 1, verse 2. It's also used of a non-virgin. It's used of Ruth in Ruth chapter 2, verse 6. Ruth was not a virgin, she was a widow. But another key word to deal with is the word Betulam. I'll spell it for you. B-E-T-U-L-A-H. B-E-T-U-L-A-H. Betulam. According to rabbinic theology, if this was to be a virgin, then it should use, Isaiah would have used Betulam, not the word Alma. Now the significance of Betulam is used in the Hebrew text. It's a general meaning of a single girl or a single woman, without regard to age. A single woman, a single girl, without regard to age. In most cases, it is used of a virgin, but not always. And sometimes, the writer has to explain what he means by that term. So keep your finger here in Isaiah and turn momentarily to Genesis chapter 24. Look at verse 43, Genesis chapter 24 and verse 43. Behold, I'm standing by the fountain of water. Let it come to pass that if the maiden that comes forth to draw to my shall say, give me, I pray you, the water from your pitcher to drink. I may have gotten the wrong verse. This was my first mistake since my last one. I don't see the phrase I'm looking for. Neither had any man known her. Let's try 24:16. 24:16. There it is. And the damsel was very fair to look upon, a virgin, Betula. Now, if that word was clearly a virgin, then you wouldn't need the next phrase. Neither had any man known her. Neither had any man known her. So Betula was clearly a virgin in every case, then you wouldn't need this explanatory phrase. Now look at the book of Judges, chapter 21. Judges chapter 21. And look at verse 12. Judges chapter 1, verse 12. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins. If that was, that's the word Betula in plural. If that was sufficient for virgins, you wouldn't need the next phrase, which says, that had not known man by lying with him. So sometimes the writers will use this explanatory phrase to show what they mean by the term Betula. But now look at the book of Joel, chapter 1. The minor prophet Joel, the second minor prophet. And look at verse 8. And here notice how Betula is used. Lament like a virgin, lament like a Betula, girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. And now we're dealing with someone who is a widow. So Betula, yes, often refers to virgins, but not sometimes it needs to be explained, and sometimes it, in a case like this one, refers to a widow. Now back to Isaiah chapter 7. So next we come to the term that's found in this text, Alma. Here's what we know about Alma clearly. It is a young woman of marriageable age. A young woman of marriageable age. Furthermore, in the seven usages found in the Hebrew Bible, it's never used of a married woman. Never used of a married woman. A Betula can sometimes be a virgin, and a virgin of any age, but the word Alma emphasizes a virgin of a young age. And in the cognate studies, like in the New Testament, it uses the Greek word parthenos, which would also be, which in Greek means a virgin, and that's the way it was understood. Furthermore, in all the seven passages we have of the word Alma, it never clearly makes them, they're never married women, and never clearly makes them to be a non-virgin. For example, Genesis 24, verse 43, Rebecca, which was read earlier in verse 16, to be a virgin. In Exodus chapter 2, verse 8, refers to Miriam, the sister of Moses. Again, these women were never married. Psalm 68, verse 25, Psalm 68, 25, it deals with women of repute, worthy to participate in a religious procession. This would be virgins. It's used twice in the Song of Solomon in chapter 1, verse 3. 1 verse 3 in the context, someone worthy to be desired. In chapter 6, verse 8, he categorizes three categories of women. There are queens, there are concubines, and there are alamot, or plural of alamot, virgins. Queens are married to the king, and any royalty to sit upon the throne would have to be a son of one of these queens. In the case of concubines, they were there for the king's pleasure. The third category would therefore be those that were still virgins, prospective wives or prospective concubines, but not yet have become one. And then Proverbs 30, verses 18 and 19, in contrast with the adulteress in chapter 30, verse 20, and the writer of this passage says, he knows how an adulteress would act given these circumstances. He doesn't know how an alma would respond, who is still a virgin. So in all the passages, there are always single women, never used of a married woman, never used of someone who is not a virgin. So when we come to Isaiah 7:14, dealing with the virgin and birth, the context requires the miraculous, something supernatural. It finally gives us an explanation of how Genesis 3:15 is going to be fulfilled. Now keep in mind, God is the one performing the sign. So if God is the one that's performing the sign, you have only two options. Either it is a virgin birth or an illegitimate child. If it's an illegitimate child, that will create a moral problem because God is the one who's doing this. And furthermore, a child born illegitimately would hardly be a sufficient sign to get Ahaz to believe, or the house of David to believe. And therefore, clearly you have to focus on this being the virgin birth. And finally, the name to be given the child is Emmanuel. And the book of Isaiah gives us a number of different names for the Messiah. This is just one of them. You have in chapter 9, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Better Father of Eternity, Prince of Peace. You have even the name of Israel applied to the Messiah in Isaiah chapter 49, and also the other titles as well. And when the parents name a child, it shows the thinking of the parents, but when God names a child, it shows the actual nature of the child, and Emmanuel means with us God, with us God. And God is the name who God is the one that names the child. So to draw some summary conclusions, the sign here knows is given to the house of David, not just Ahaz. The seven times the term is used in the Hebrew Bible, never is it a reference to a married woman. And the context requires something supernatural to create faith in Ahaz, to create faith in the house of David. And the flow of the context demands a virgin birth. So in chapter 7, Emmanuel to be born in the future. Chapter 9 is viewed as being born. And in chapter 11, as already ruling in the Messianic kingdom. Now, here's the issue the rabbis come up with. What good is this sign if it's really what we claim it to be? Which won't happen for seven more centuries. What benefit is the sign to Ahaz? What benefit will this be to him? And that would be a valid criticism. For example, if it came to me with some kind of a spiritual problem, and I was to say to you, listen, you don't have to worry about a thing. And I'm going to give you a sign that will give you confidence. Seven centuries from now, this and this is going to take place. Well, you won't be very much comforted by that kind of a sign. The person giving you the sign won't live that long. You won't live that long. But notice in verses 15 to 17, he goes back to the singular. He now provides a different sign for Ahaz. For the house of David, it will be the virgin conception, the virgin birth. And so the house of David cannot lose its identity until you have the conception and the birth of a virgin-born son. That's the sign for the house of David. The sign for Ahaz is in verses 15 to 17. And here again is the definite article for the child. Now, once again, for the child or the son, if you have a definite article, you look for the immediate context. Was it not the son mentioned? Yes, back in verse 3, God told Isaiah to bring his son Shai Yeshua with him. And so it's got to be a reason for him to be there. And the point of verses 15, 16, and 17 is this. That before Shai Yeshua is old enough to make moral choices, to know to choose the good and reject the evil, the two kings threatening you will be off the scene. They will no longer be a threat to you. They will be off your back. And they'll disappear. Now, this was fulfilled for Pekah, 2 Kings 15, 29 and 30, 2 Kings 15, 29 and 30, for Rezin, 2 Kings 16, verse 9, 2 Kings 16, verse 9. Now we come to verse 17. Again, Ahaz was putting his trust in the Emperor of Assyria and the Assyrian Empire. So now, Isaiah tells him, if you want Assyria, you'll get Assyria, but much more than you want. Because when Assyria destroys the kingdoms of the Arameans and the kingdom of Israel, the Assyrians will not stop at the border of Judah. They will also take over Judah, and Judah will become servitude for the next several decades to the empire of Assyria. And because Ahaz did not trust his own God, but trusted the emperor, now he'll be a subject of the emperor and no longer be a free reigning king any further, but a subjective king to the Assyrian Empire. And what he does then in verses 18 to the rest of the chapter, describing the Assyrian Empire, the Assyrian invasion, right through verse 21, actually should be verse 25, and to show how Judah fell to be subterfuge and a subjective to the emperor of Assyria. And the fulfillment of this is found in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verses 20 and 21. 2 Chronicles 28, 20 and 21. And now look at Isaiah chapter 36. When Hezekiah became king after the time of Ahaz, he was a good king, one of the best kings according to the prophet evaluation of him. And generally he obeyed the prophecies and the admonitions of Isaiah, but he allowed himself to be talked into to rebel against the empire of Assyria. And Isaiah warned him against doing so, and his one act of disobedience was his rejection of the prophetic voice of Isaiah. And he joined Egypt and other nations to rebel against the Assyrian Empire. And now he suffers for it. And while Assyrian Empire and the Assyrian army arrived to Mount Carmel, all the other kingdoms aligned with Hezekiah came to Assyria and submitted to him. And now Judah stood alone. And now, this is Sennacherib, now the new emperor, he will destroy 46 of the fortified cities of Judah. And now he's going to besiege Jerusalem. And now look at verse 2 of chapter 36. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fullest field. The very same spot where Isaiah confronted Ahaz and told him not to rebel, but to submit to the God of Israel, and Ahaz refused, and Judah fell under Assyrian empire authority. And now Hezekiah is being threatened, and the leadership of Assyria stands at the very same spot where they have previously confronted Ahaz, showing that what Isaiah warned has happened, and that the prophecy is about to be fulfilled. Sennacherib took so much, he failed to take Jerusalem because Hezekiah repented. And therefore he was freed from seeing his city destroyed, but he was back under subjugation to the Assyrian Empire. So if we look at the context and break down the Hebrew wording and so on, we clearly have a virgin birth prophecy. Even within certain evangelical circles now, they say there's a double fulfillment here. It was fulfilled one way in the days of Isaiah. It was fulfilled a second way in the Matthew chapters 1 and 2. But if it did not require a virgin birth in Isaiah's day, then there's no reason to need to believe in the virgin birth in the Matthew Gospel and the Luke Gospel, with which they make clear that Miriam was a virgin. But if we stay with the text, understand the differences, what's happening here between single and plural and so on, it is a prophecy with a singular fulfillment. And that singular fulfillment is fulfilled in Matthew 2 when Mary or Miriam gave birth to a firstborn son, and that is Yeshua, Jesus. Last time I was here, I told you several rabbi stories. I didn't write down which ones I told you, so I want to repeat myself. But about 5 minutes left, I'll tell you a story that has a Jewish connection. It's about a Taliban terrorist running from the authorities. He's fleeing to the desert. He's run out of water. He's getting desperate. He looked up on the horizon, and he saw what might be an oasis. And every oasis has water. When he got to what he thought was an oasis, he doesn't see any trees, no water. All he sees is an old Jewish man selling ties. And there were stacks of ties that from a distance could have passed for trees that he thought he saw. So the Taliban terrorist asked the Jewish man, "Don't you have any water here?" Jewish man says, "I have no water, but I have all these nice ties, only $5 apiece." The terrorist says, "I don't want your Western garments. I am an Easterner, and I need some water." Jewish man says, "Like I said, I have no water, but look, I've got this nice silk tie, only $5. Terrorist says, "I hate Jews. I want to kill Jews. I wish I had the strength now to take this tie around your neck and kill you. But I need to reserve my energy. I need to find some water." Jewish man says, "I'll show you I'm a better man than you are. You hate me because I'm Jewish, you won't even buy a single tie, but I'll show you I'm a better man." If you simply walk straight between these sand dunes, after about a kilometer, you'll get to a crossroads where there's a nice restaurant there, has all the water you could possibly want. So go in peace, and may God bless you. As the terrorist leaves, he yells out, "I may come back and kill you yet, but right now I'm going to reserve my energy." He's gone for a while. After a while, he comes crawling back, crawling on his knees, crawling on his hands. He's got a $5 bill in his hand. He says, "They will not let me in without a tie."